Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. It's November 3rd, and we have a huge docket for you today. First, Mark Means strikes again. Next, the Kyle Rittenhouse case has begun. Some highlights. More finger pointing in the Alec Baldwin homicide case. A happy story in Western Australia. I guess you could say Crime Talk is going international. A case where the dead guy probably deserved killing, and I'll explain, but don't get upset just yet. Brian Laundry. That's right. He was probably dead the entire time that everyone was looking for him. And then finally, our dumb criminal short of the day. Let's talk about it. Good day, Crime Talk aficionados. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk, the most fact-driven, unbiased, true crime channel. The channel where a practicing criminal defense attorney actually explains to you the facts, the procedure, and the law regarding cold cases, as well as current true crime matters. Welcome to the show. If you haven't done so already, please hit the subscribe button, hit that little bell so you receive notifications of when we go live and put up new content. And as always, leave me a comment below about the discussion that we have today. And remember, if you can't watch, you can always download Crime Talk on all of your podcasting apps like Apple, Spotify, iHeart, Android, Amazon, and Audible, anywhere you're looking to do that. Let's support the people that support Crime Talk.
Amazon Music has more than 10 million free podcast episodes, including Crime Talk. Amazon Music isn't just for podcasts, though. They have thousands of music stations and playlists you can stream for free. No credit card required. If you want your music on demand and ad-free, try Amazon Music Unlimited. You'll get ad-free access to over 75 million songs, podcasts, and more. You can listen anywhere, even offline, or you can connect to your Amazon device and use with Alexa. I listen to Amazon Music with my phone, through my car's Bluetooth, when I'm traveling to and from the office. Some of my favorite bands are the Avett Brothers and AC/DC. For a limited time, new customers can try Amazon Music Unlimited free for 30 days. No credit card is required. Go to amazon.com/crimetalk. Renews automatically. Cancel anytime. Terms apply.
All right, let's get to the docket for November 3rd, 2021. Well, Mark Means is at it again. And what can we say about Mark Means? Well, he's filed a motion, and it's really the identical motion that he's previously filed, asking for contempt proceedings against Melanie Gibbs, alleging that she should turn over basically any communications, recording, documents, email, you name it, he's asked for it, alleging that there's been some sort of improper communications between the prosecutors and Melanie Gibb, as well as potential witnesses and Melanie Gibb. He's also gone out there on the limb and said that there may be the destruction of exculpatory evidence as it relates to Lori Vallow. Although there's no explanation as to what evidence has been destroyed, which you would think you'd maybe want to describe that in a motion to show cause. No, Mark Means has only said that she has previously been served, she's had sufficient time, and no attorney has contacted her. He just alleges that she was properly served. She said that she, quote, refused service. If you can really do that, no, you can't. And that she should have complied. Now, here's the thing. When you get a subpoena, you have to respond. Even if there's nothing there, you have to respond to say, I have nothing in my possession. But as I tell my young associates, there's an easy way and there's a hard way. Everybody always picks the hard way. I'm not sure why Melanie Gibbs just won't respond and say, I don't have anything in my possession, or if she does to get it. Or if she thinks that the subpoena is overly burdensome, file a motion to quash the subpoena, and therefore she doesn't have to respond. But she's not doing that. And once again, Mark Means, there's an easy way and there's a hard way. If you believe that there's been some sort of inappropriate communication, well, then you subpoena the people that have the records, right? Who is she supposedly communicating with? Well, why don't you ask those people to produce those records? He only seems to go after Melanie Gibb. You can subpoena the district attorney's office if you think something's there. And guess what? They have to turn it over. But to go after the same person saying, well, now you really have to turn this stuff over. Well, you know what? The judge dismissed this motion outright last time. And I think it'll be kind of dismissed again. And when I say dismissed, it wasn't even argued, at least not to the public. But the reality of it is that if Melanie Gibbs has no information, or if she's relayed that information to the prosecutor can probably relay that information as well to Mr. Means. What is also interesting, normally when you have a co-counsel case, even if not from the same office, you list the co-counsel in all of the pleadings. Now, Mark Means has filed two pleadings in the last couple of weeks, both kind of like, why are we doing this? Because, well, really, the case has been stayed as it relates to Lori Vallow. So I'm not sure when they're supposed to hear this because the matter's been stayed. The point I also have here is, where is Mr. Archibald in all this? Remember the co-counsel guy with the actual criminal defense experience? The guy who, you know, would probably want to be on these pleadings if he thought it was appropriate. And he would usually state in the beginning, comes now Mark Means and Mr. Archibald, James Archibald, and hereby on behalf of their client, do this, blah, blah, blah. The standard boilerplate thing in every motion. His name has been not present on any of those two motions. He's not even in the certificate of mailings, ladies and gentlemen. Makes me think that Mark Means is doing this on his own, and I don't get it. Remember the last motion? He basically is alleging that somehow the staff is having Lori Vallow communicate with the legal counsel for the Church of Latter-day Saints, and this is all part of the bigger plan to somehow get him off the case. Why does he want to be on this case so much? He's getting paid state court-appointed counsel rates. The money's gone. Maybe it's his 15 minutes of fame, but I can tell you, Mark Means, I've taken those cases in my younger career thinking, oh, this is going to be a great case. I'm going to get so much publicity. Guess what? It never works out. You're never going to recoup any of those time and dollars that you put into this case. If this is not an economically viable case, you simply have to get off. And frankly, why don't you talk to Mr. Archibald? Just a professional tactical tip here. Why don't you talk to the guy that does this stuff for a living? All right, next on the docket, Kyle Rittenhouse. The trial has started. Some highlights. In the Kyle Rittenhouse case, in opening statements presented Tuesday morning to the Kenosha County Circuit Court panel, prosecutors said that the evidence is going to show that Rittenhouse was an active shooter whose reckless behavior led to a deadly incident. Thomas Binger, a Kenosha County Assistant District Attorney, told the jury multiple times during his presentation, the only person who killed anyone was the defendant. But the defense countered that the same evidence indicates that it was reasonable for the teenager to use deadly force to defend himself from what he claims was a mob attacking him. Riots, vandalism, and looting broke out over a police officer shooting Jacob Black in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and a call for armed patriots was sent out online to come and protect the city. Now, Rittenhouse, who was 17 at the time, answered this call for help, according to his attorney, Mark Richards. Richards used a series of photos and videos in his statements to show Rittenhouse being kicked, hit in the head with a skateboard, and having a gun aimed near his head when he shot and killed one man, Anthony Huber, and severely injured Gage Grosskreutz. Now, but Binger told the jurors that the fatal face-off started minutes early when Rittenhouse chased an unarmed protester, Joseph Rosenbaum, and shot him four times, including a fatal shot to the back in a used car lot Rittenhouse claimed to have been protecting. Binger argued that there was nothing reasonable about the behavior of Rittenhouse that night whatsoever. Binger also suggested to the jury that Rittenhouse, who was armed with a rifle with a 30-round clip, was the aggressor who sparked the deadly confrontation. Now, the video taken in Kenosha, Wisconsin last August, in which you can hear the fatal shooting that the teenager fired at Joseph Rosenbaum, as well as the single gunshot another man seconds earlier, was shown a few times. Both the prosecution and the defense agreed that the initial shot was fired by Joshua Zeminski, a figure likely to take a prominent role in the trial. Now, Zeminski, 36, was charged with disorderly conduct using a dangerous weapon, arson, and obstructing an officer, and he's pled not guilty, according to court records. A criminal complaint says he and his wife admitted to firing a warning shot in the air that night. and Rittenhouse's attorney, Richards, blamed Rosenbaum for escalating the violence that led to his killing, as well as the killing of Huber and wounding of Grosskreutz. Now, Richards said the evidence will show Rosenbaum had threatened to kill Rittenhouse and others who were attempting to protect property early in the evening. He claimed Rosenbaum, who was allegedly setting garbage cans on fire, found Rittenhouse isolated from his cohorts and that he attempted to steal the teenager's gun and use it on him. Now, Richard displayed photos that he said show Rittenhouse using restraint from shooting people approaching him with their hands up, including Grosskreutz, when he initially approached Rittenhouse after he had been knocked to the ground and kicked. He claimed Rittenhouse only shot Grosskreutz when the man aimed a gun near his head. He then said Rittenhouse fatally shot Huber after Huber allegedly hit him in the head with a skateboard twice, the second time after the teen was on the ground and kicked in the face by an unidentified individual. The prosecution called his first witness, Dominic Black, the boyfriend of Rittenhouse's sister, who allegedly purchased the rifle for Rittenhouse and joined Rittenhouse in Kenosha on the night of the killings. Black said that during the protest, he was positioned on the roof of the car dealership. He claimed protesters were throwing rocks, at least one gas bomb at him, but he said neither he nor anyone on the roof retaliated. Black admitted that the rocks being thrown at them were painful, but it didn't make him feel as though he was in danger and that he wouldn't have considered using deadly force. Trial. On cross-examination, Black said that during the protest, he witnessed Rittenhouse providing aid to injured protesters and confirmed he told investigators the only person I saw helping anyone that night was Kyle. Black also said at one point he heard gunshots go off in the distance where Rittenhouse was. He said, quote, I didn't believe the gunshots were actually his until I got a phone call. I answered it and he just said, I shot somebody. And then he hung up, end quote. Black testified also that Rittenhouse returned to the dealership, freaked out, pale, sweaty, and then they left Kenosha and drove to Rittenhouse's home in Illinois, and Rittenhouse surrendered to the police the next morning. Now, this trial is set to last 2 weeks. We're bringing it to you live on Crime Talk, so it's worth watching. It's going to be a significant case, and look at it not from a political side. Look at it from the facts, whether he acted reasonable or not. The finger pointing has begun in the Alec Baldwin case, and Alec Baldwin is insisting he doesn't believe the conditions on the set of Rust were chaotic or unsafe, which led up to the fatal shooting. Baldwin reposted a long message from a woman claiming to have worked on the film, who is attesting to safety meetings and normal working hours on the set, as well as defending the armorer, Hannah Gutierrez Reed. Now, the crew member, Alec Baldwin reposted, also claims that the crew had hotels. They just didn't think they were fancy enough. Now, as for Gutierrez, the post says, was she the most experienced person? No. Were her qualifications typical of a tier one? Yes. But how do you suppose anyone will get that experience? We all had a first job and a second job, one point or another. Finally, the reposted crew member speaks to what she wishes she had done differently and maybe could have saved Helena Hutchinson's life. She said, I'd call out an AD who was handing a gun to an actor, not because that's my job, but because never want someone to lose someone I love again. Baldwin spoke with the paparazzi over the weekend in Vermont, telling them the Hutchinson accident was a one in the trillion and that the Rust set was tight. He also said that the Santa Fe Sheriff's Department warned him not to speak to anyone about the case. Duh, that's just good common sense. Now, Hannah Gutierrez Reed, the armorer, is now making a bombshell suggestion that perhaps somebody intentionally put a live round in a box of dummy ammunition. Gutierrez Reed's attorney, Jason Bowles, and Robert Gorenz appeared Wednesday on the Today Show and outlined their sabotage theory and went so far as to consider potential would-be culprits. They revealed the person who could have slipped in the live bullet would have had access and opportunity to do so between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m., when the ammunition was left unattended outside on a tray. They also say Hannah wasn't even in the church during the incident because it wasn't a filming session nor a rehearsal, but an opportunity to figure out camera angles. What they didn't admit, though, was that the gun's chamber was indeed inspected and spun by their client, and they say that she put in six rounds thinking they were all dummies and didn't realize the live round had been placed in the mix. After that, she pawned it off to an assistant director, David Halls, who went into the church with Alec Baldwin and the rest of the crew. Now, Hannah made statements last week saying that she had, quote, no idea there were live rounds and where they came from, insisting that she and the head prop master gained control of all the guns on the set each day. She said she never saw anyone use the guns or put live rounds in the firearms. Her attorneys dragged the production team and the defendant Hannah, saying the whole production set became unsafe due to various factors, including a lack of safety meetings, and that, well, they're advocating for their client and said this was not her fault. Okay, they got out there, they got their word out, they got their theory out there. So Gutierrez's attorneys have got their theory out there that somebody else was responsible, not my fault, even though as the armor, she's the one ultimately responsible. I get it, they're all in damage control, they're all pointing fingers. Why? Because the attorneys know that a lot of people have some real liability and exposure here to criminal charges, and they're trying to get ahead of it, and they're trying to spin the case. The best thing, in my humble opinion, is always to keep your mouth shut. But if you're gonna talk, make sure it's done through the attorney. Next on the docket, Crime Talk goes international and is for, well, a nice heartwarming story for a change. Here we go. A 36-year-old man is in custody in Western Australia, suspected of abducting a four-year-old named Cleo Smith from a campground, taking her 45 miles away to Carvanovan, where police found her early Wednesday. Now, Cleo was last seen at about 1:30 a.m. on October 16th when she asked her mother for water, and when the family woke a few hours later, she was gone. On October 25th, police announced that a vehicle was seen leaving the Blowholes campsite about the same and realized she was abducted. Police so far revealed few details about what led to the locked house where they found the little girl or the so far unnamed man who was taken into custody at another location. The tip came in on Tuesday night, and it was just what investigators needed to bring Clea Smith home. The tip had something to do with a suspicious car. No other details were revealed. Police Commissioner Chris Dawson came to the scene from Perth on a police plane to pick up the suspect, as well as to talk with investigators who cracked the case and to meet Cleo's parents, Ellie and Jake Smith. The commissioner also said that the suspect had no family connection with the Smiths. Now, the deputy commissioner, Colonel Blanche, said there were seasoned detectives openly crying with relief at the rescue. Watching live videos, officers broke into the locked house and one of them picked up a little girl and asked her name. The rescue of Cleo, I mean, she said, my name is Cleo. I don't think there was a dry eye in the house. All right, a case where maybe the dead guy deserves killing. Okay, I know some people say, Scott, you can't do that. You can't say that. I understand it. We can't have vigilante justice. We need to have due process of law. I get that. But wait till you hear what this guy did and tell me if you weren't the father or mother of somebody, this maybe wouldn't have crossed your mind. Just think about it as we go through. Let me know in the comment. A 60-year-old man is accused of killing his daughter's boyfriend, who allegedly sold her into sex trafficking and leaving his body in a car's trunk for nearly a year. Now, in October 2020, John Eisman learned that his juvenile daughter was allegedly sold into a sex trafficking ring in Seattle. Eisman reportedly learned there was a possibility his daughter's boyfriend was involved in this transaction. That same month, Eisman was able to rescue his daughter and brought her back to Spokane. Then in November of 2020, Eisman reportedly found out that the boyfriend, Andrew Sorensen, was going to be in Airway Heights, Washington. Spokane police said Eisman waited for the victim and then confronted Sorensen when he arrived. Police alleged Eisman abducted the victim, tied him up, and placed him in the trunk of a vehicle. Eisman allegedly hit Sorensen in the head with a cinder block and then maybe repeatedly stabbed him, which was ultimately the thing that killed him. Now, according to the spokesperson from the police department, Eisman kept Sorensen's body in the trunk of the car to North Spokane County, where he abandoned it in a remote area. Nearly a year later, October 2021, Spokane police believe a third party moved the vehicle to 1800 East Everett. And then on October 22nd, the police responded to the East Everett address because there was a foul odor emanating from the car. According to police, individuals were rummaging through the car and taking items when they made the discovery. Sorensen's hands and ankles were bound by zip ties, and he had tape over his mouth. Officers confirmed human remains were, in fact, inside the vehicle. The car, a 1991 green Honda, belonged to Brenda Cross. She was engaged to Iceman, and their daughter is the juvenile who was trafficked. Iceman confessed to killing Sorensen. Police said Iceman had no violent criminal history and was arrested and booked on the charge of first-degree murder. His bond is set at $1 million. Now, understand, I know everybody's entitled to due process. I get that. We can't go around having vigilante justice. But think about that. If that was your daughter who's being sold into a sex trafficking ring, that'd probably be one of the first things that crossed your mind on what to do. He confessed to it. If I were Mr. Iceman, I think that I would take that case to jury and go with the defense of the dead guy deserved killing. It's called jury nullification, and see what the chances would be. What does he have to lose at this particular moment? None at all, right? This is like a scene out of A Time to Kill, that John Grisham novel. I'm telling you, I would take that one to trial, because anything more than maybe a few months in jail, you just go for it and you let the jury decide to see if it was appropriate or not. And like I said, there is a thing out there called jury nullification. Attorneys can't argue jury nullification, but smart jurors know what is jury nullification. Next on the docket, I keep thinking that this was the last Brian Laundry story, but we've got one more, but it'll be quick, all right? So it turns out that the Brian Laundry remains that were found on October 20th in that Florida nature reserve near his notebook and backpack that ended this five-week manhunt, and he disappeared in the wake of his fiancée Gabby Petito's death. Well, the FBI has positively identified the bones found as Brian's, thanks to dental records, but the coroner could not determine the cause of death. Now, Laundry's remains, due to the condition the remains were in, but the coroner could not determine a cause of death from the remains due to the condition that they were in, because they'd been out in the swamp for, well, 5 weeks. Well, the sheriff said that Brian went out there and by all accounts probably committed suicide, and he was right out there where they thought that he was the whole time. Now, they also believe that particular area, that the remains would have been under about 4 feet of water and admitted to human error in the search, explaining cops trailing Brian, though they saw him going back to his parents' house, but mistook him for his mother. So they basically waste a lot of time, a lot of speculation. There you go. The reality of it is he was probably dead the whole time, and everybody spent all that time on this case, including Crime Talk. And I have to admit, I was wrong. I thought maybe he had jumped off to Mexico, or Cuba, but he didn't. He was just dead. I was wrong. I admit when I'm wrong. All right. If I hadn't mentioned it before, this is day three in Tampa. And the people down here are just lovely. I don't know what it is. I'm telling you, when you go to the South, it is like a different world, and in a good way. It's like people have manners again. I love it. I love it. Now, people in Denver, very nice. You go to some other places, I would say west of Colorado, and sometimes things aren't as nice. But, you know, it's usually the people right there on the coast. Just leaving it at that. But there's some nice people out there. Not everybody. I don't want to generalize in any way. All right. Let's get to our dumb criminal short. And as always, thanks for watching.
Crime Talk's dumb criminal of the day.
A suspect in Florida was fleeing a traffic stop when they dove off a bridge in an attempt to get away from Florida deputies. Deputies were trying to pull over 34-year-old Brian Gray for driving a stolen van, but he sped off and he crashed the vehicle into the barrier at the top of the Edison Bridge in Fort Myers. That's when the sheriff's office said Gray got out of the van, jumped over the safety barrier, and dove off the bridge and into the river below. The aviation unit kept an eye on the suspect in the water while the sheriff's office marine unit pulled Gray from the water. He was transported to a nearby hospital for treatment. And while he may not have earned a gold medal for his high dive, Gray did find himself in a bit of hot water when he earned charges of grand theft auto and fleeing and eluding.